You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people.
Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast and YouTube channel that features two guys discussing science fiction horror films, key, hence the title, influences on those films, and then key things that those movies in turn influenced since they were originally produced and presented. We've been doing this for quite a few years now, but if you are new to us, thank you so much. We're so glad you're here. We want to give you a big warm hug and say please do all the stuff that all of us podcasters and YouTubers ask you, which is ring the bell, subscribe, look into our website, find out a little bit more about us. If you found us just because of the movie we're covering today, there are lots of other films that we have covered over the years and continue to cover. And we're glad you're here. If you are returning, yay, we're glad you're back. And we would urge you to do the same thing. Even if you've left us a review in the past, every review helps us find new people, helps us get the word out more about the show. So we'd appreciate any support you have. My name is David. I'm here with my good friend, Tim. Tim, we normally start with, genre topic of the week. What you been doing? So what you been doing, Tim?
Wow. My genre topic of the week.
Yeah.
I went back in time 50 years.
50, basically. Okay. 50 whole years. Okay. Great.
Yeah. Actually, 51. I went back. You know how? I'm always trying to watch movies on various streaming platforms, usually movies that I haven't seen. And this one is one that I have not seen. I have always heard about it. And for some reason, never got around to seeing it. Came out in 1972. I caught it on Turner Classic Movies because when we are in October, I tend to gravitate towards the classics.
I know, and it's almost Halloween now.
Yes. Right, okay. Right. So I went and watched a movie called The Other. This movie was a very popular movie in 1972. It was written by someone that we have talked about on the podcast, Tom Tryon.
Okay.
Tom Tryon starred in I Married a Monster from Outer Space. He was the closeted gay actor that eventually got sick of Hollywood and decided to start writing novels. This was his first novel, and it was a runaway bestseller.
Okay.
The second one was Harvest Home, which I believe I've talked about in a past genre week in the past. Anyway, this movie, I somehow, have you ever seen it? I have
no.
Never seen it.
I have not.
Okay. It's got a very unique spoiler twist that I will reveal since the movie is over 50 years old.
Yeah.
But it was directed by, it was directed by a guy named Robert Mulligan. I immediately confused him with Richard Mulligan, the guy from,
from Night Court.
Empty Nest, yeah. and Soap, but yeah. It is not. That is Richard Mulligan. This is Robert Mulligan. Mm. This guy was nominated for a Best Director for doing To Kill a Mockingbird.
Okay.
Like I said, it was written by Tom Tryon. The screenplay was based on his novel. It stars Uta Hagen, who was a stage actress from Germany. Diana Muldaur, remember her?
Oh, yeah.
The twins were played by Chris and Martin Udvarnarki. I think they were German, too. And it also stars a very young Victor French, who you may remember from Little House on the Prairie.
Yes.
And a very young John Ritter, who you may remember from Three's Company.
Mm, okay.
Though it was really popular at the time, Tryon was very disappointed with the result in this movie. He had high hopes of casting Ingrid Bergman as the grandmother. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen. He wanted Mark Lester for the twins. That's Mark Lester's the kid that played Oliver in the movie Oliver.
Okay.
Also, post-production editing due to the film caused over half of Jerry Goldsmith's score to be removed. So that was a big minus there as well.
Okay.
The synopsis is, in the summer of 1935, 12-year-old twins Niles and Holland Perry live with their family on a Connecticut farm. Their loving grandmother, Ada, has taught them something called the game. A number of accidents begin happening, and it seems to Niall that Holland is responsible. And it is Ada who begins to see the truth, and she is the only one that can stop this murderous game. Do you remember the big twist of this movie? Do you remember anything about this movie?
No, I remember nothing about
really,
this movie.
Really? I'm totally shocked. Okay, well, it turns out that Niles is both Niles and Holland, because Holland is dead. Holland was killed. Niles is a little psychopath, like that girl in The Bad Seed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he's also clairvoyant, and that's where the game comes in. And the grandmother can help him or communicate with him via this game. She ends up figuring out what's going on, and she ends up taking her own life as well as his, because okay. he ends up killing a baby that was John Ritter and his wife's.
Sometimes you have to kill the babies. It just happens.
Yeah. Sorry if I'm giving away too many spoilers. This movie scores 83% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Dang.
And honestly, other than it being a bit dated, and it is very dated for today's standards, I think it's a well-deserved 83. It has some truly terrifying moments in it.
I think we're going to have to revisit the nomenclature of, like, dated. And maybe classify it like we do theater, you know, where we say it's a period piece, you know, kind of thing. So if you accept it for the time when it was made and what it is, to me, that's not dated. That's the best they were doing back then, you know, kind of thing. Or, you know, sometimes you and I will refer to dated meaning, oh, it covers subject matter, or it has characters, or it has references that probably wouldn't be socially acceptable now based on new norms. But we need, I think, a different word for that. You know what I mean? Because I think we, especially on this show, appreciate the dated cinema of the past for what it was. You know, Frankenstein Absolutely. For when it was released, you know, The Omen for when it was released, kind of thing. So,
well, what I meant with dated is, it is a period piece, but it was filmed in the early 70s. So some of the production values are a little lacking.
Yeah.
So that's what I meant.
Okay. And that makes sense. You know, we talked, I think it wasn't last week, but it was another week about, you know, the film we were covering, you know, looked like it was a TV movie because of the cheaper sets and the cheaper budget and everything else. But that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well, now that you've got me intrigued, I might actually have to check that one out.
I mean, it had been on my list for a long time. I think you remember I talked about watching The Dark Secret of Harvest Home, which was like a two-night miniseries with Betty Davis not too long ago, and it was terrible. But they're both books that were runaway bestsellers by Tom Tryon in the 70s. So.
Interesting. I have finished, because I think if you remember last week or week before, my genre week was I had started dabbling into Black Mirror, the new season's out, so I wanted to watch it. I finished it, and I think Charlie Brooker needs to give you and I a call so we can help him with next season, because he definitely
Well, you told me that he was crossing over into horror world and doing like werewolf episodes or something.
Unfortunately, yes. Yes. And he was... okay, so Black Mirror, you know, I think I mentioned last time, it's had a checkered past. It started out as a BBC series, which means a BBC series means you get three episodes. So you have the time to kind of devote to those episodes. And they can be a little bit longer than an hour. And they, you know, get a little bit more story and that kind of stuff. It was bought by Netflix, and suddenly it jumped from three to six episodes a season.
and not bad. It's been on for 6 seasons. This season, though, I would have to say, despite what I'm seeing on some of the reviews, is the worst season of the series.
Would you say they descend? Would you say that the first season was best and it just goes down from there?
No. No, I would actually say season 4 is probably the best season overall.
So it's a climax and now we're in the denouement.
Yeah, yeah. Now we're okay. Definitely the denouementing sort of thing. Last season had one episode, I think, that I kind of liked, and the other one not so much. And then it had a Miley Cyrus episode, if you put it that way. It was classified as the Miley Cyrus episode. So,
Hannah Montana.
So not the best. Some of the concepts in this season were good, but not fleshed out and not as horrific as things have been in the past. And like I said last time and said this time, it delves into horror, straight up horror this time, as opposed to what has always been the core of this series, which is, you know, technology gone amok. Issues with society and technology. I think IMDb actually put it in a cool way. How modern the Black Mirror anthology unveils how modern technologies can backfire and be used against their makers. Every episode is set in a slightly different reality with different characters combating different types of technology. Cool. Except 2 episodes this season have nothing to do with technology, period. Unless you count a mystic rune as technology, or you count a camera as the only, meaning it's an episode about paparazzi.
So it's Paranormal Activity.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no.
That's a camera.
It is a camera. But just, I mean, I'm talking about a photo camera like paparazzi. So.
Okay.
However, those 2 horror episodes this season, if that had been as a separate series, you know, Horror Mirror or, you know, Black Stallion, I don't know, something else, like his version of American Horror Story, they would have been fine. I would have loved them.
Okay.
Because I think
so they're good. They're good. They're just out of place.
Yeah. As scary television, I think you would really like them. And I would recommend them for you. But as far as some reflection on our society and technology, which is the reason I love the series, no, they don't do that at all. So I think he needs, you know, and he writes all of these. So that's why sometimes you have a year in between a series kind of thing, kind of like Gaddis is with Sherlock. You know, everybody's still waiting for the new season of Sherlock because he hasn't written it, sort of thing. That sort of thing. So the premises are always intriguing and cool and neat and different, and this one not so much. Great performances, great photography, some really cool stuff to it, just not the premise of Black Mirror. And nothing eclipsing what they did in season 3 and 4. Season 3 and 4 were just brilliantly done. So
interesting.
So there's that.
That's too bad. I've always wanted to visit the series. I haven't, because like you, we have lists that go on forever.
Yeah.
And horror tends to dominate mine.
But I would gladly, if you wanted to start with these 2 and then switch over to the sci-fi, and then there's 3 that are just brilliant television scattered through the 6 seasons. So yeah. I would recommend those because they're scary, you know.
And scary is a great segue for our topic of the week.
Yeah.
For all of you out there, it is October 30th, and ooh, I cannot think of really much better of a movie to cover on Halloween than a little ditty called Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
Sleepy Hollow is, well, I have a lot of connections with this. I don't know if I've ever told you, I think I may have mentioned it on the podcast and just lately, but I'm actually a descendant of Washington Irving.
No.
Yes.
You are not.
I am. My mother is an Irwin by birth. That's her maiden name. Uh-huh. And her roots have been traced all the way back to a castle in Scotland called Drum Castle, which was Irwin de Cronin and the bassist of King Duncan for the Macbeth legend. I know you know that. I knew that.
Yep.
Yeah, I have those connections. However, Irwin is... That name is constantly switched. The W is constantly switched with a V. So it can be Irwin or Irvin. And Washington Irving is an ancestor on my mother's side of the family. So, you know, he wrote this little ditty called The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which Tim Burton directed, shortened into Sleepy Hollow, and took quite liberties from the story. I'll tell you that because I also read the story before we're going into this.
I did too. Yay! Yes, I did too.
There you go. Well, how do you want to start? Do you want me to just give a brief synopsis of the movie?
Yeah,
first?
For those of you who haven't seen it, we will spoil the hell out of it. So watch it right now and then come back to us. And then Tim will tell us what it's about a little bit.
Yeah, this movie takes place, it starts in New York. Johnny Depp plays Constable Ichabod Crane. He seems to be annoying a judge played by Christopher Lee and some of his cohorts with his ridiculous inventions and theories and stuff. And I guess as a sort of punishment, Christopher Lee kind of sends him off to Sleepy Hollow in upstate New York to solve some beheading mysteries that's going on up there.
Yeah, go up there. Gets rid of him. Handle that.
So he is a constable. So he's kind of a detective in this version of the story. Yes. And there are beheadings going on, very gruesome beheadings. And as he's there, it's a really creepy little town. He meets someone named Katrina Van Tassel, who is sort of the romantic interest in this. She is tied to Brom Van Brunt, who is, I guess you could say, a brief rival of Ichabod's before they actually kind of unite. And there's a little bit of a mystery going on in the town as to who this killer is, if it is supernatural or if it is one of the townspeople. And there are several actors that we have seen familiar faces playing those townspeople.
Oh, yeah. Is great
this
cast.
The first? Yeah, it's an excellent cast. Is it the first time you've seen this movie?
I think I saw it when it came out, but I did not remember it at all. So this was essentially a refresher, if not the first time I saw it. Yeah.
What did you think of it?
I tried to word this so I can figure it out. I think this is probably Tim Burton's second best movie. I think Eraserhead is his best movie. I think this is his second best movie. I think it is his second best.
Did you say Eraserhead?
I meant Edward Scissorhands.
I thought you did. I was going to say Eraserhead's David Lynch.
For some reason, I even got that in my notes. It says Eraserhead, and I went, no, that's wrong. So Edward Scissorhands, I think, is Tim Burton's best film. I think this is his second. I think Nightmare Before Christmas is his third. And I think Batman is his fourth. But I think
I could probably get on that wagon.
I think it's his second best film with Johnny Depp. However, I caveat that by saying I think Johnny Depp is miscast in this part. I think I think had he pulled back the quirky just a little bit, he would have been perfect. Because I love his innocence in this, especially with the modern Johnny and, you know, playing Jack Sparrow for so long.
Sparrow.
And so many of the other ones. Even the mafia guy he played. So White, I think, was his name. But anyway, the innocence he gives Ichabod is really cool and obviously inspired a bit by the novel, in that Ichabod in the novel is a little bit, is obviously an outcast and weird and doesn't fit in the town and everywhere else.
But Depp just adds that quirkiness, which has become such a moniker of his performances, especially
it's
his
very Marlon Brando.
Mm-hmm. That now I'm suddenly pulled out of the moment because, oh, there's an actor doing his thing. You know, it's the same way I felt about Willy Wonka. I thought he was a terrible Willy Wonka and should never have been cast in that role. But that being said, I think Burton did a phenomenal job in translating the original work. I think the aesthetic is excellent. I think the pace and the storytelling works too. I love the fact that, you know, Depp's character, obviously the scientist of the times, he's what you would call probably an alienist at that time, which was the term they used for using the scientific method above just, you know, beating a confession out of somebody and that kind of thing. But so he goes into this saying, okay, I'm going to bring modern science to this small community, and we're going to show that it was obviously a person who is doing this. And then suddenly, by about halfway through the movie, nope, it's not a person. It is definitely a spirit, and I'm terrified.
And that scene is one of my favorite scenes.
Great.
I was just going to say, I totally agree with you. I think it is one of Burton's best movies.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that you enjoyed it. I think it's a great Halloween movie because
it's a great Halloween movie. Watch it tonight, folks. It is so good.
And it is a love letter to gothic horror. I mean, yes. It is just everything you want and scary. You know, you can watch an old Universal movie and it looks cool, but it's not really scary. This looks cool and it's scary.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And I disagree with you a little bit on the quirkiness of Johnny Depp's character, and because I know the reasons why he did it. And it's because Ichabod Crane is normally played as a very unattractive character that is very cowardly. And Burton did not want Johnny, even though Johnny wanted to, wear the prosthetics for the role. I mean, he wanted the long chin and the hooked nose and to be tall and gaunt and very weird. But Burton was smart in saying, I think you can do that with his mannerisms and not have the appearance. Because Burton knew he could have Johnny be somewhat marketable as a romantic lead. And I think that's why that happened.
Agreed. So, I mean, I don't think that's wrong. I had in my notes that his original interpretation, he wanted the goofy ears, the hooked nose, all of that. But that, again, like you said, Burton wanted him to stay that charismatic character too, which makes sense. I don't have a problem with that. I just think there are times when they cut to that Burton reaction. I mean, that Johnny Depp reaction. He's like, and does a weird, quirky face or something. And you're going, I didn't need that. That took me totally out of the frickin' moment. You know, I liked the way he played, you know, to the point we just mentioned, the scene where, and it's almost it's a good comic relief moment because, A, he's just seen what in the novel is the villain of the piece, meaning Brom. He's just seen Brom cut literally in two, and he's taken to his bed, and he's terrified with the sheet and everything. And Gambon's character walks in, and all of their dialogue is great. It's a great comic relief scene based on the horror we just saw.
It's hilarious, and he plays it so well. Oh, yeah. It's like Academy Award winning.
It's a horseman, and he's headless. Yes, I know. Horseman, yes. Headless, yes. I told you that already.
And then without any like notice at all, he faints. I mean, and it's so subtle. He just kind of falls.
It's great.
Awesome.
So had a whole movie been played like that, fine. But then when you've suddenly got, you know, the big climax happening with the horseman and with the mom and all that, and it cuts to Depp and he does one of his little, you know, quirky looks, I'm going, I didn't need that. I didn't need that moment sort of thing. Did you
do you want to talk about production of it and some history going into it?
Well, we can do that, or if you wanted to talk about the story. I didn't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about the source material or not.
It was really neat rereading the story, because I had not read it for forever and forever. You know, this to me, I think when I originally read it in middle school, this was kind of touted as the first American fairy tale. You know, this was similar to the Grimm's tales, but with an American bent kind of thing, which I thought, and I remember seeing the animated when I was a kid, and basically anytime you ask somebody what's the story of Sleepy Hollow or of Ichabod Crane, they can sum it up in like two sentences. You know, oh, that's the school teacher who is scared by the headless horseman who has a pumpkin for a head. Okay. And what else? That's it. That's all I remember from the story. You know.
Well, and it's a very short story. I mean, it's less than an hour read, I would say.
Yeah. I would consider it a novella at the most kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It did teach me the word pedagogy and a pedagogue, because he uses it repetitively in the story. And that was the first time when I was a kid, that was the first time I'd heard those words and had to look those up and found out, oh, that's a school teacher. Cool. I like that name.
Yeah. And it's played more. They do this in the movie where they play the mystery of it potentially being someone in the movie.
Yes.
That's killing these people. The story is more of a mystery because they basically allude that it is Brock that's doing this.
I think the story is...
Because they're competing for Katrina, basically.
Correct. The story is... The fairy tale of the story is the ugly, nebbish hero going to get the girl, like Beauty and the Beast kind of thing, which is a huge key from this, or is... You know, or is the handsome Gaston character going to get him when he, especially after he pranks him? But in the novel, he disappears. Ichabod Crane is the victim in the short story and disappears. And then there's just that little coda at the end where they're hinting at he could have run away and hidden, or maybe he really was killed, or, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So,
right. I think the changes that, well, first of all, the screenwriters of this movie are pretty big. I mean, this was written by, or adapted, I should say, by Andrew Kevin Walker. And you know the last thing we did with him was Seven.
Seven, yep.
Which is a very gruesome movie.
Oh, yeah.
But it was originally a project for Kevin Yeager.
Yep.
Now, Kevin Yeager, if any of y'all know out there, is basically the makeup guy for Freddy Krueger. Yeager has always been in makeup and effects, but he wanted to be a director. And this was originally going to be a Kevin Yeager project written by Andrew Kevin Walker. Mm-hmm. But when Burton expressed an interest, all of a sudden things changed, because Burton had, you know, skyrocketed with Edward Scissorhands. And I'm not sure what else had come out between the two. But Kevin Yeager said, you know what? I still love this. I'm going to stay on and do makeup. No. So Kevin did the makeup for the movie.
I think Kevin had learned a lot, too, because he did the Crypt Keeper, too, right? In Tales from the Crypt. I think
he did that.
He designed that puppet and that makeup and everything, and was used to that kind of collaboration on that series, because I think he was head makeup for that entire series, the first, mm-hmm. you know, 2 years or whatever. I think it would have been interesting to see Yeager's take on this, but I think from what I've read, he wanted like a kill every 5 minute slasher movie. That's the way he wanted to update it. And I think that would have been a mistake compared to...
I do too.
Because my other notes say that the studio is actually the one that came with the pitch to Burton to say we want it more like The Crucible, which is a great key for this. And that's mm-hmm. cool. That's really a cool idea.
The Crucible. I don't have that. That's a good one. So I think it was very wise. Well, first of all, the Andrew Kevin Walker screenplay, as you can imagine, was a lot darker than the movie we saw.
I'm sure.
And when Tim Burton came on, he hired the famous playwright Tom Stoppard to do a script doctoring on it. And perfect. That's why I think this movie is so good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he brought the character and the nuance to all the little characters that are in this movie together. Plus, I think they went with the original Andrew Kevin Walker origin story, so to speak, of the Hessian and, mm-hmm. and the, you know, the slaughterer or whatever. And that was actually in the story as well, briefly. It was mentioned that he was a Hessian that was a mercenary hired during the Revolutionary War.
Well, and a cool thing I'll say about the screenplay, too, is it does what screenplays do best, which is almost every scene ends with either a question or a question in our mind kind of thing. Scenes stop, and we're right in the middle. And now we're on to a new scene. And that keeps propel this sort of story all the way through, which I thought was really cool idea.
Right. But another thing that Burton did that was really great about this movie is he paid homage to other versions of this, including mm-hmm. the animated version that Walt Disney did with the bridge scene and the flaming pumpkin scene. All of that was from an animated film I remembered yep. as a child.
Oh, yeah. That's why I yeah. said the flaming pumpkin head is what you remember when you think about Ichabod Crane. The Headless right. Horseman is not just a guy galloping around with no head. He is holding a flaming pumpkin.
Right.
You know.
I have a Halloween tree ornament of the Headless Horseman with a little light-up pumpkin in his hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas in this movie, other than that one scene, the rest of the time, he's just a Headless Horseman. And it's pretty freaking scary, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the effects in this movie are great. I think I sent you a behind the scenes. I don't know if you watched it, but it's great. It's got interviews with all the cast and the effects and stuff. What else? Okay, so that's a little bit about the production.
I have a couple other production notes. I have
sure, go ahead.
I have this was produced by Francis Ford Coppola.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't know that you know that he this was in that period where he was using that Godfather money to fund people to do good work.
From what I understand, Tim Burton didn't know either. It kind of nope. surprised him when he found out.
Yeah. He didn't know at all. I also have, Adam Schroeder is one of the key producers of this. And he's the one that actually approached Burton. And the only reason that Burton was able to do it was because his version of Superman, which is what he was working on, was shut down. It was called Superman Lives. It was the one where Nicolas Cage was going to play Clark Kent and Superman.
I seem to remember this.
And it got shut down after initial testing God. And everything else. And that's when Schroeder went to Burton and said, hey, since you're not doing anything, got this movie here, would love to have you. And Burton said it was, you know, fortuitous, mostly because of what, I'm sure we'll get to it in Keys, but the inspirations he wanted to bring to it sort of thing.
Right, which was his love of old horror movies, basically. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I have that... originally, this was going to be shot in one place, but they decided instead to actually film it in England and build every set. So the entire town of this was built in a big, huge open field for this movie. And I thought that was great because it worked really well.
It does work really well. The forest is on a soundstage as well.
Yep.
Everything was really easy to control because of it.
Which gave him a lot of...
I think I read were like the day before Christmas, like Christmas Eve or something, was the day they were just filming Johnny being dragged around in the leaves.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something. I saw that somewhere.
And my last little production note I had was... Because when I watched it, I thought, I really like the aesthetic he's done. This blue overtone to everything gives it this really gothic feel. To your point earlier, and mm-hmm. kind of, but I was thinking, what was the process? Did they wash out the film? Did they do whatever? No, they actually put blue filters on the lens of the camera. So because of that, if you look at stills of the production stills, the blood in this is orange because that's the only way they could get it to look really, really red with the blue filtering that they were doing.
How funny.
So, yeah, he was literally blueing the camera out, kind of like shooting Day for Night does.
Well, I was just about to say, I remember Edward Scissorhands looking the same.
Yes.
So it must have been something he did for Edward Scissorhands, too.
I think he likes that aesthetic for the coldness of it. You know, the blue tends to make people feel cold and distant. But it also gives it this really shadowy, gothic, not a black and white, but almost a black and white feel, which is what this movie has. All the way through it. You know, you've got a picture of Walken there who looks, you know, as the Headless Horseman, who looks horribly pale and washed out. But so do the girls. So does Mom. Mm-hmm. So does, you know, the Ichabod character. All of them. So,
yeah. Actually, I just thought of another key. This, I lost my train of thought. Scenes.
Yes.
Do you want to, are you okay?
Okay, my number one scene, I've got to tell you, it will always be now burned into my head for this movie, is a little boy underneath a cellar. His mom's head gets cut off above him and rolls over and falls with the eyes looking through the floorboard down on him. I went, holy crap, that's a terrifying image. That's awesome. I mean, oh, my gosh.
The storyboarding for this film was very precise, I have a feeling. Because, I mean, everything looks like it's lifted from a comic book frame.
And, you know, we've seen so many horror movies with heads or beheading and everything else, and they look terrible or unbelievable or like a puppet or bad. You know what I mean? This one... The only one to me that I didn't like was the magistrate character or whatever, when his head spun around before it fell off. And they actually had a special rig to spin his head around before it fell off his body. I didn't like that one. But all the other beheadings and the heads that they show, you know, people holding up or carrying around or whatever, are realistic. Jaeger's makeup looks really good.
You didn't watch the special I sent you.
Yeah. No, I watched it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, because it showed them doing the live cast of the actors, so they would have those heads look really real.
Yeah, and if you look inside, you can see the spinal column and the muscle and the larynx and the esophagus.
Where it's like being cut like a microscope slide. Yes, exactly, because the blade cauterizes. It's like a supernatural blade, and it cauterizes so there's no blood. And then, of course, he goes back and gets the heads. It also, on that special, they show how they make him look headless, because they didn't want that old effect that, like, when I go to Mickey's Not-So-Scary Halloween Party, I see a horseman headless riding down and leading the parade. It's on a real horse. But you can tell it's a guy with, you know, an extended torso. It doesn't look real. This, they digital, you know, he wore a green mask so they could digitally remove his head, but then they added a digital collar to give it more depth and more reality, so it looks like there's nothing inside that collar. And I just thought it was fascinating how they did all that stuff.
Oh, it was great. All the behind the scenes was really good. And, you know, that says a lot about Ray Park, too. This is the guy who played Darth Maul. This is an incredibly good stuntman who's great with his body and great with portraying menace, especially. And even the way he rides his horse and the way he pulls his horse up short and turns his body, all of that looks great and is so well done.
Right.
I mean, the horseman is freaking scary in this.
Absolutely. And my favorite scene, when we're still talking scenes, is the scene where Magistrate Phillips gets murdered. He and Johnny Depp are in the field, and he's like, the horseman's coming, and Depp has not seen the horseman yet. And then you just see that fog and the woods and him come riding out, and he's not after Depp. He's after the magistrate, and the magistrate starts running, and he basically rides by Johnny Depp, lops off the magistrate's head. Johnny has fallen, and the magistrate's head rolls down and lands right in Johnny's lap.
Yep.
The horseman does a 360, comes riding back to get that head, and just basically stabs it with his sword like an olive yep. in a cocktail and goes riding off.
Yep.
And that's the scene that precedes my other favorite scene of Depp in bed, terrified.
Yeah.
Absolutely out of his mind, scared
to death.
Because
he faints at the end of that one. He does the whole boom, back.
Yeah, he faints at the end of both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he faints remembering it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's just classic cinema. I mean, it's the kind of thing that I think you could easily see on one of those reels we talk about that they show at the Oscars.
Yeah,
they can show that scene.
I've got in my favorite scene, so I said the mom's head in the floorboards. The horseman attacks, especially the horseman attack at the very beginning, I thought was very well done with Martin Landau and the carriage. And the pumpkin splattered with blood in the cornfield, all of that is really, I mean, Scarecrow, that was really cool and classic and very gothic and great. And I've got my last scenes are any scene with Ichabod's mother when he's having his dreams and nightmares. I like the way they approach that. And I think it's the only thing that really doesn't follow through in the storytelling. I think it was probably a holdover from the original script that they didn't kind of close at the end kind of thing. Other than the fact
The only thing I can think of that ties it is the little bird that the little toy that he spins.
Right, bird in the cage.
Looks like it's in a cage.
Yeah.
And he specifically says it shows us that things are not always how they appear.
Right.
Or things don't seem as how they appear, which is what this movie is based about. I mean, there are things in this movie that are not the way they appear.
Yeah.
You're right. Other than that little notion, I don't know really what else they were doing those flashbacks with his mother for.
Yeah, because basically the story we gather from it is young, impressionable Ichabod is seeing his mother, his father's religious oppression, i.e. crucible-esque
right.
kind of thing. And when she even draws anything in the sand or the ash from the fireplace, he thinks those are magical runes and beats her. Ichabod ends up essentially in a nightmare, whether it happened or not, finding her in an Iron Maiden. You know, and she falls right. out of it, spiked, and blood pours. It's very shining and all of that.
And he has scars.
And he has scars from the other device, which was the one where they clamped you to the chair and with all the nails in it. And they're going into your palms, which is another way, you know, got to find the witches. Got to root those witches out.
So it also, another purpose it served then really is basically his choosing science over religion as well.
Yeah. And I thought the other metaphor they may play with is, you know, him and her at the end, basically being able to say, you know, well, both of our mothers, you know, suffered a lot from the supernatural sort of thing.
Right.
You know, I loved that storytelling-wise, too. I love the whole twisting at the end and the witch stuff and everything. I love that. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, me too. I mean, there's not much about this movie I don't like. I really, really like this movie. But you just reminded me, you were ranking Johnny Depp / Tim Burton movies. Mm-hmm. And one that did come out before this that you neglected to mention is Ed Wood. And Ed Wood is up there too. That's a great movie.
It's okay. It's not my best. Again, I think all I see that entire movie is Johnny Depp being weird. Kind of thing.
Well, Ed Wood was weird.
Well, Ed Wood was weird.
And Martin Landau won an Oscar for it, and that's what made me remember it, because Martin Landau is in this movie, but he's uncredited, and he's in that original scene.
Yeah.
He's the first person to get his head chopped off,
correct.
Basically.
Because he's the courier for the Duke or whomever, the guy. Yeah, the Lord Van Zant or whatever. Yeah.
Correct. And that's a great scene, too. I mean, this movie's loaded with great scenes.
Yeah. And the performances are done in such a way that they're all memorable, even though short. Christopher Lee's got one freaking scene. He's got like three sentences. But I remember him from it.
you know?
And Michael Gough came out of retirement to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
He's only got two sons. Yeah. Yeah.
But both are memorable yeah. and both are good. The cast for this is really strong all the way through.
Oh, another scene that I love going back is the flashback scene with the Hessian
oh, yeah.
being chased by the people. And he comes across those two little girls mm-hmm. who play into the story later, obviously. And he looks at them and does that. And the little girl goes, crack.
Yeah.
Bitch. It's like comic relief. And it's hilarious, man. It's so funny. She's like this just little defiant girl that just goes, no,
yeah.
crack.
I have in my notes that Christopher Walken does not have any lines in this movie.
Mm-mm, he doesn't.
Yeah.
Which is good because he would sound like Christopher Walken.
Yeah, yeah, he would.
The ice is gonna break!
yeah, good. That would be good. Yep.
No, he just growls, and he has sharp teeth, and, well, we'll get into the casting later, but he didn't know very much about horses. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about scenes. Did you have any other notes or trivia
no.
you want to get to before I go to casting?
No, I think casting's fine.
Because I have a lot on casting.
Sure.
Because this movie's full of a lot of great people.
Okay.
What do we have here?
I mean, my Washington overview Irving. Of casting, which you probably didn't get at all, is this is like a checklist of actors and actresses, actors now, from the Harry Potter series.
It is.
Yeah.
But it's also a checklist of some actors from Hammer movies.
Hammer
as
movies
well.
As well. Yep. True.
Mm-hmm. British, so to speak. Mm-hmm. British actors.
Yep.
I've got that the film includes two Oscar winners, Christopher Walken and Martin Landau, and two Oscar nominees, Johnny Depp and Miranda Richardson.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got some clout there. As you said, as far as the Harry Potter thing, there are five people who were in the Harry Potter franchise. Mm-hmm. Miranda Richardson, who played Rita Skeeter.
Yep.
Michael Gambon, who played Professor Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore. Richard Griffiths, who played Uncle Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Depp, who I didn't even know Johnny Depp was in the Harry Potter movies.
He's in the prequels.
Okay. Yep. Well, he played Gellert Grindelwald.
Uh-huh.
And then Tony Maudsley, who voiced Grop.
Yep.
So that's one, two, three, four. Yeah, five people.
Yep.
Starting off, we have Johnny Depp, who played Ichabod Crane. Of course, we know him as Captain Jack Sparrow. He has played Sweeney Todd in an unfortunate version that Burton screened or directed, and Edward Scissorhands. You know what? I actually have a note that this is like his fifth or sixth collaboration with Tim Burton.
I
Sweeney
have it
Todd,
as
Edward
his
Scissorhands.
Overall, but it's his second in a row. He had only done Edward Scissorhands prior to this with Burton.
I think he had done Ed Wood, too.
Oh, that's right. You're right. Ed Wood was before this.
Yeah. He had done Edward Scissorhands, Sweeney Todd, Corpse Bride, Charlie and Chocolate Factory. I mean, he's done a slew of films with Tim Burton. They like working together, quite obviously.
Yep.
I read or saw some, it may have been in that documentary where Johnny said, if Tim Burton calls, I take it. You know.
Of course.
That's. We also know him from Nightmare on Elm Street, of course. That was his debut. Liam Neeson, Brad Pitt, and Daniel Day-Lewis were all considered for this role. Liam Neeson seems a little old to me.
But Daniel Day-Lewis would be good.
Yeah,
and he would have more of the classic look of Ichabod. Those gaunt
Agreed.
Features and everything, yeah.
I also have a note that this was merely a formality requested by the studio because Johnny Depp was always the final choice for Tim.
I'm sure.
Tim Burton says of Johnny Depp, he is the best fainter in the business.
Obviously, because he did two of your favorite feints.
Right. And he also wakes up good for me. So he wakes up well.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny has never seen the movie. He doesn't like the way he acted.
Well, he doesn't.
In it, he says.
Yeah.
I've heard he doesn't watch lot of his movies, actually.
I think a lot of actors are that way. They don't like to watch themselves.
I don't. I don't watch myself when I'm in a show.
If going back and watching myself makes me cringe. So Christina Ricci played Katrina Van Tassel. This is a character from the novel, or the novella, correct, as you had mentioned. We know her from playing Wednesday in the Addams Family movies, and then she went on to be in Wednesday, the series, not playing Wednesday, but playing a teacher at the school there. Winona Ryder was offered this role, but she turned it down.
Yeah.
Because she had recently broken up with Johnny Depp, and so that was not going to be, that was probably some bad blood there, I'm guessing.
That's okay. Burton can get her for Beetlejuice.
Right. And Johnny initially found the idea, though, of working with Christina Ricci being his love interest odd, because they had first met on the set of Mermaids when he was dating Winona Ryder, and she was a little girl. So it was odd for him to have like a kissing scene with someone he had known since she was a little girl. And I could see that. That is kind of weird.
Yeah, well, maybe.
And I like Christina Ricci a lot. I do think she might have been a little miscast in this. Yeah. What do you think?
I agree.
She's not a romantic love. I mean, she's not like a romantic lead to me.
No, Winona is much more of a romantic lead actress than Christina. And also, this part is not written very well for that character in general. She basically doesn't even have a rebellion against her mother kind of sequence. You know, she's pretty much a damsel in distress the entire time.
Well, it's revealed that she's a white witch too, because she's drawing like pentagrams to protect him and things like that.
Or trying to.
As well.
Well, I got the impression
it's a red herring.
Yeah. Trying to, you know, she plays that kind of straightforward, whereas in the novella, you know, she's pretty much, she can be sassy in the novella because she's playing both of these boys against each other kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't get that a lot with this film with her. So yeah.
No, as a matter of fact, the only interaction between the three of them that I recall is his introduction to the town when she's blindfolded and kisses him, and Von Braun or whatever his name is sees it and gets jealous.
Yep. Yeah. Makes sense.
Miranda Richardson is in this movie. Mm-hmm. She was in The Crying Game, which is a good movie, as well as The Hours, which is a movie I love and a really great novel. She played Lady Van Tassel / the Crone, because we learn later that she is the adult version of one of those little girls that is first to witness the Hessian bee.
She's a twig snapper.
She is. Either she is or her sister is. And subsequently, she ends up being the villain of the piece. She turned down the role of Alex in Fatal Attraction. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but makes sense.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that role kind of put Glenn Close on the map.
Yeah.
I mean, we already knew her from The Big Chill, but Fatal Attraction's what, you know, made her skyrocket.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a role that I bet she regrets turning down. Michael Gambon played Baltus Van Tassel, her husband, and Katrina's father. Michael Gambon has 172 acting credits. Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
He's amazing. He's incredibly good. You know, you may not know it, but in the Harry Potter series, the original two films, Richard Harris played Dumbledore and ended up dying. And Dumbledore is a huge character, so they had to recast him. And they picked Gambon, and there were people saying, oh no, his voice is too low, he's going to be too mean, yada yada, that sort of thing. But he's brilliant as Dumbledore, and especially the way that Dumbledore's character evolves over the novels. So I really think he's a strong, strong actor. He's very good in this.
Well, not only did he play Dumbledore, he was also in movies like Gosford Park. I mean, he's been around.
It's that
he's
voice.
A National Theater. He worked at the National Theater under Laurence Olivier.
Yep.
So You know, you can't say much better about,
and he's a contemporary of Patrick Stewart. He's a contemporary of a guy that plays
Ian McKellen.
Ian McKellen. Yeah.
You're talking about Magneto.
Yeah,
yes. Casper Van Dien is no stranger to us. We have covered another movie that he is in on our podcast, and that would be Starship Troopers.
When you're through fighting giant bugs, you need to get yourself cut in half, buddy.
I misspoke. We've covered two of his movies. He's also in Alita Battle Angel.
Oh, yeah. He is. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I don't relate Casper Van Dien to being in very big movies, but he's definitely, I guess, a B-movie actor because, Starship Troopers is definitely what I would consider a B-movie, even though it was
I think it's unfortunate because, money. You know, he has classic good looks. And, you know, was probably just born at the wrong time when there was a lot more good looks around kind of thing. So he didn't get cast when he could have sort of thing.
Yeah.
So,
but yeah. I read somewhere, it's probably in my trivia for later, that he is actually a descendant of some Van Tassels up in New England.
Wow.
So he could potentially be related to the people this was based on. Because I read that Washington Irving did base this on some people that he knew.
He could be one of your distant cousins, you know.
Sort of. He could be. I mean, but I'm on the Irving side. He's in the Van Tassel side.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Jones.
Oh yeah.
Plays the Reverend Steenwick. Jeffrey Jones is another one of those actors that turns up in a lot of Tim Burton projects.
Usually playing a nebbish or a bad guy, bully. Yeah.
Beetlejuice. He was the principal in Ferris Bueller.
Ferris Bueller, baby. Yeah.
He has since
Mr. Rooney
fallen off the radar. Yeah, he's had some legal problems. We'll just leave it at that.
That's enough. Yeah. We'll leave it there. Sadly.
Richard Griffiths played Magistrate Phillips.
Yeah.
He is another Shakespearean actor that's also gone all Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah. Very Harry Potter. In every movie, I think. He is in every single film. Yeah. All 10.
And he is my favorite kill in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? Ian McDiarmid played Dr. Lancaster.
Yeah.
Did I mispronounce it?
I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Diarmid. It sounds like Irish or Scottish.
I think he is Irish, yes.
Okay. And he is the evil emperor in the Star Wars movies.
He is Emperor Palpatine, yes.
I mean, this movie is full of, like, acting gold. It really is.
Someone I saw online had phrased it as, he's the guy that comes back at the end of every Star Wars trilogy as the bad guy. I went, yep. All three of them. The emperor comes in at the end as the bad guy.
Yeah. Michael Goh.
Michael Goh.
Another powerhouse that I adore. He played Alfred in Tim Burton's Batman movies. He's a classic Hammer and Amicus actor.
Yeah.
He was in Phantom of the Opera, Horror of Dracula, The Skull, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. I mean, the man is just, as far as my map, he's up there. Because of his horror background.
Yeah, he and Christopher Lee are the Hammer clout of this movie. Definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
And he plays Notary Hardenbrook. He came out of retirement, I think I mentioned, to do this role as a favor to Tim Burton.
That's awesome.
And Tim was, it was filmed in England, so it wasn't like he had to go very far.
Yep.
And I love his first scene. Where he's sitting there in profile, but then when he turns and looks up, one of his eyes is white and then blind, scary, scary looking. The Hessian, the horseman himself, was played, as you mentioned, by Christopher Walken. We know him from The Deer Hunter and The Ice is Gonna Break! The Dead Zone.
Yep.
Do you know who the first choice was to play this? And I do not get it at all.
To play the Hessian?
Yes.
I don't know. No.
Marlon Brando.
Why? Why would
first of all, he would have hijacked the movie.
Yeah.
Second of all, he was already way too heavy to be on a horse.
Yeah. Need a big horse.
I can't see him riding a horse.
Yeah, no.
I mean, this was around the time that he was resurfacing, but he was doing those Matthew Broderick movies, I believe, in the 90s.
Yeah.
Remember?
Mm-hmm.
I think he did one with Johnny Depp. He did one with Matthew Broderick. But he was still heavy. He was not a light actor anymore.
No.
He was. I've got here, you know, Moreau. Dr. Moreau was in 1996. He has a reputation for ruining that movie.
Yep.
And that he weighed about 400 pounds. So there you go. Let's see. Christina Ricci revealed on the Rosie O'Donnell show that Christopher Walken was very shy and quiet. So cast members had a competition over who could get him to say the most words.
Interesting. Okay.
Actor games. Miranda Richardson won this contest by asking him lots of questions.
Good.
Smart. Who else? Mark Pickering played the young Maspath. I don't know him from anything else. Do you?
No.
He's fairly prominent in this as a sidekick for Ichabod, but because his parents are murdered and he has no one else.
But so I don't Ichabod remember kind of him from it. Anything else. He may have done something after he aged up, but I don't remember anything.
Right. Lisa Marie played Lady Crane in the flashback sequences that you mentioned,
yes.
Ichabod's mother.
Yes.
She is a very familiar face because she was a one-time girlfriend of Burton and in a lot of Burton movies.
Okay.
She played Vampira, I believe, in Ed Wood. She was the woman in Mars Attacks. She's in that as well. And she was also in Planet of the Apes.
So she's in his bad movies. No, just kidding.
Not all of them. Ed Wood is not a bad movie.
It's okay. You have to kind of like Ed Wood to appreciate the Ed Wood movie.
Well, it's a docu-movie. Or what's that?
No,
I don't know if it's a docu-movie.
No.
Is it based on a book? I can't remember.
Don't know.
It's about a director.
Yeah.
It's a behind the scenes of Hollywood.
Yes.
Steve Waddington played Killian. Don't know him. Claire Skinner, Beth Killian. Okay. Christopher Lee played the burgomaster that sends Ichabod to upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
We know him, of course, as Dracula.
And Count Dooku.
Was that like a Dracula alias?
No, Count Dooku is one of the characters in Star Wars who actually works for the Emperor. They have scenes together.
Isn't he in Lord of the Rings too?
Yeah, he's Saruman. He's the villain.
Sauron, yeah.
Not Sauron, he's Saruman, the one that's a contemporary of Gandalf. Yeah.
Right. I don't know his modern movies. I know his horror movies.
You know the
movies.
Good movies.
Look at who you're talking to here.
In
Christopher Lee's memoirs, he credited Tim Burton for revitalizing him and his career, which he considered was floundering by this time.
Oh, wow.
He had had a failure with a movie called Jina, J-I-N-N-A, in 1998. Lee expressed that this movie, Sleepy Hollow, made him become more recognized in the public eye and helped him receive the role of Saruman, as well as Count Dooku.
Mm-hmm.
Dooku. So he doesn't think he would have gotten those roles had it not been for this movie.
Maybe. I mean, that's...
So that's...
I'm glad he did. He's great at both of those roles, but...
Yeah, I agree. And I agree that he deserves to be in other movies just because he has a bad movie. While filming, Tim Burton told Christopher Lee that he had always loved Hammer movies, especially ones that he had been prolific in, and that directing this was the closest he would have to directing an official Hammer movie.
Agreed. I think Hammer's a huge key for this, although he doesn't use the Hammer aesthetic photography-wise or lighting-wise at all. But he does. It does feel like a Hammer story, the way he tells it. So.
Mm-hmm. And then lastly, uncredited, we mentioned the first murder is Martin Landau in a coach. I mentioned know him from Ed Wood, as well as a movie we covered, Alone in the Dark.
Mm-hmm.
Love him in that movie, even though you think that movie's terrible. I absolutely adore that movie.
I want the hat.
And like I said, he really has no lines in this at all either. He's just basically murdered.
Yeah. Yeah. He gets to be scared and run through a cornfield.
Yeah. As far as awards, this movie won an Academy Award for production design. And I think it's well deserved.
I do too. I don't know what it was up against, but yeah, I think it's definitely got great production design, from costuming down. I mean, just look at behind you. Just the dresses that those little kids are wearing are amazing.
Right.
So yeah.
Or that dress that Katrina has on with the hood.
Yeah. The tree design, you know, is very gothically inspired. Very, you know, children's fable, Grimm's fairy tale kind of feel to it. All that. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, it was nominated, as you said, for costumes and visual effects, but it won for production design.
Yeah.
So it was nominated for 3 Academy Awards. The BAFTA Awards, it also won production designs and it won costumes.
Good.
So BAFTA, British, gave it 2, probably because it was filmed in England.
Yeah.
It was nominated for visual effects there as well. Our friends at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror, the Saturn Awards, gave it a win for actress, Ricci, and then they nominated it for actor, supporting actor, Walken, which is hilarious because he has no lines.
He has no lines.
And supporting actress, Richardson. This movie is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die. And I think that's a shame.
I do too. I would put it on the list. Yeah.
Compared to some of the stuff that's on there, in a heartbeat.
Yes.
In a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what I have for a casting and awards. Did you have some other stuff before we move on to keys?
I know you've got some trivia maybe. I've just got some of my watch notes, which I thought were interesting. One was... I did like the whole prequel story of the Hessian and how it was told, and with the girl, like you said, with the girls and the way he was killed, mm-hmm. and his body thrown in the grave with no head and all that. Was Depp the best?
Well, I think the head, it was, the head was thrown in the grave. I'm guessing that.
Yeah, it was tossed in with him, but separate from his body. Yeah. He'd already been beheaded. You know, yeah.
Yeah, and I think one of them little girls stole it, and that's how she got the power to call the Headless Horse.
Oh, yeah. Not one. Yeah. Mom. Mom stole it, and because she ends up, yeah.
Well, one ended up being the mother that married into the Van Tassel family. The other ended up being the old witch in the woods.
Right. And she even killed her. So, yeah.
Yeah, in a flashback down at the end.
I've got in my notes, was Depp the best choice for this? He seems to be overplaying it a little bit. Then I've got, okay, now we add the eyeglasses and we suddenly turn it into Edward Scissorhands.
I really don't have a problem with Johnny Depp in this movie. I think he's great.
Long time with no Ricci. Where's her character? Witch's snake eyes were a little too much CGI. I agree with that. You know, when she took her veil off and all of a sudden this snakes come out on stalks. Yeah, very Beetlejuice. Good. That's a good point.
Yeah, yeah. That is one thing. If there's anything I don't like about this movie, it's the cartoon effects that pop in sometimes.
Yeah.
They're too comical.
I've got, the head through the floorboard. I mentioned that. I've got Brahm. Wow. That was quick. He has a much bigger part in the short story. great.
Yeah, he gets axed quick.
I've got fairly decent transformation of the Headless Horseman at the end. And then this was before I watched the trivia or read the trivia and researched it, but one of my notes is, man, this really makes me want to do the Crucible again. And then suddenly they turn out and say that's one of the inspirations for it. Yeah.
Were you in that? I can't remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I was in it once, and
I used to go to rehearsals and watch it, but all I remember are the women. I don't remember, and maybe Doug Gray. I don't remember anyone else in that.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great play. It's always been a great play.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I think Bill Collins was in it too, wasn't he?
He was the lead. And then my last one was, I love the lighting effects, lightning and lighting and the storms, the way he would do that. And so, because always before the horseman appears, there's lightning.
And fog.
Yeah, it's really good. Really cool. Keys or trivia for you?
I thought I had some trivia, but I don't. I don't see any. So I can move on to keys if you're done.
Okay.
One of the keys I had, I wrote down, the Crucible because you had mentioned it, but it got me thinking when you started talking about how authentic the set looked and how they built it. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking about The Witch in the Woods. All I could think of was The Witch, the Robert Eggers movie.
Yep, that's a good one, too.
I mean, there's a lot of this movie reminds me of that. The atmosphere and the dreariness of it.
Well, it's the same time frame.
Mostly from the set.
Same time frame. Mm-hmm. But that one, to me...
No. The Witch was a lot earlier. That was like in the... This is in like the 18th century. This is... Because they go into the 19th century at the end of the movie. The Witch was in like the settlement, like the 15 or 1600s, wasn't it?
I think it was 1700s. This was 1800s. Yeah. This was like 1890s, 1880s, late 18, that sort of thing.
Okay.
But I mean, I can see your parallel because it feels the same, that provincial, small town, cut off kind of feel to it, the isolation mm-hmm. of it. Similar to what I have, although it's a Poe thing and not a Washington Irving thing, but Pale Blue Eye, which I recently saw, would be a great companion piece to this. They're both mysteries. They both have supernatural elements. They both have very unique murders in them. So this would be I was a definite key in my opinion. You had mentioned Universal and Hammer horror films. So both of those were an influence on this and Depp's Depp and Burton's kind of interpretation. I also have in my notes that Johnny Depp said he used Basil Rathbone and his version of Sherlock Holmes and Roddy McDowall as an influence on Ichabod, as a key influence. And I thought I could see that, especially Roddy McDowall in like Fright Night.
In that scene where he's in bed. It's very Roddy McDowall. Yeah.
And Roddy McDowall. I wish Johnny had learned, because Roddy McDowall can play that quirkiness without it seeming insincere quirkiness. You know what I mean? Roddy McDowall's always been able to play that innocent, cowardly sort of.
He gives it emotional resonance because. Right. He had a lot of pathos in Fright Night because he was a failed actor. He was hosting a horror movie show, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, I just looked it up. The Witch was set in 1600s.
Okay. My fault. Good.
No big deal. But I seem to remember looking up this particular movie because the Revolutionary War was in the 1700s. And I think that when they go into the city at the end, which I love, by the way, I would love to see sequels with him being a detective with that
in
little
New
kid
York?
As a sidekick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, do the Rue Morgue or whatever. I don't know. And I want to say he said it was a new century. And I think it was the 19th century, which would have been the 1800s.
Oh, makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I digress again. I have, you mentioned, and earlier I mentioned, both of us have mentioned, the fact that there's a clear homage to, like, Hammer films.
Yes.
In this. But Tim Burton has specifically said he was also inspired by the gothic horror films of Mario Bava. We covered a Mario Bava gothic horror movie last year. Well, one of them was gothic. It was an anthology called Black Sabbath. Ironically enough, Michael Goh and Christopher Lee not only did Hammer movies, they both did Bava movies as well.
Interesting. I've got to tie into that because I found online one guy's reference is that this is also a great example of Gaio
Giallo,
because it is a mystery and horror together.
It's a murder mystery, and it's gruesome.
Yeah.
And Giallo, but Giallo is usually modern. This is like a period Giallo.
Period
piece.
Giallo, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a direct Universal reference in that, in the windmill, of course, and them climbing down the windmill and it catching on fire and all that. That's very Frankenstein. So I've got...
And that was intentional, too. Tim Burton mentioned that in that docuseries, or that documentary.
Yep.
Yep.
I had mentioned Beauty and the Beast just because, literally, Beauty and the Beast, Gaston, I mean, Brahm is Gaston. So well interpreted kind of thing. So yeah.
Well, I don't understand. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, he's like the asinine boyfriend.
Oh yeah.
Gotcha.
Who has followers all over town, and everybody knows that he's the best, and he thinks he's the best. Blah blah blah. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I've got a key to the story itself. However, I'm going to read it because it's long and it's from IMDb.
Okay.
The idea of the Headless Horseman actually dates back to the Middle Ages in Europe, largely in Celtic and German folklore. While Washington Irving's Horseman can be considered the most famous, most areas of the United States during the time of the story's publishing had their own stories of Headless Horsemen. Irving's is said to be inspired by the headless body of a Hessian, which were renowned sharpshooters and horsemen, who was found in Sleepy Hollow. The real Van Tassels buried him in an old Dutch mill, or in an old Dutch burying ground in an unmarked grave.
Wow.
So, I mean, all these legends were circulating. You know that he just kind of was picking from them when he wrote that story.
I've got a
plus
key.
Plus, there were Van Tassels.
I've got a key that says that the original Washington Irving story is like a dated version of Creepypasta. And I went, yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's the exact same thing of this urban legend kind of thing that has taken root and is going through the culture. I thought that was interesting.
And evolved, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a weird one, Telltale Heart, because Michael Goh reminded me of Telltale Heart as soon as he turned around. I thought that's the guy from Telltale Heart that the old man and the eye that keeps him awake, and that's why he has to kill him because he's got that one cloudy lens, you know, in his eye.
Right. I mentioned earlier that they pay homage to the Disney cartoon version of this, and I don't remember if this is the same thing or not, but. It apparently was featured in The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad. I don't remember Mr. Toad being in that cartoon. I thought it was just a... Anyway, it includes a scene in which Ichabod crosses a covered bridge and hears frogs underneath croaking Ichabod. And he does that in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear them going, Ichabod, Ichabod, and Headless Horseman. The following chase sequence where Ichabod is run down and unhorsed, apparently by the Headless Horseman, and the moment in the climatic chase scene in which he runs into a tree limb and is thrown through the air.
Yep.
And ends up landing on the Headless Horseman's horse backwards.
Yes.
So all of these things were from that cartoon. Whatever it was. I guess it was called The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad.
Well, again, as we've said before, you can pay homage to previous things if you do it cleverly enough. And
it's great. I mean, the humor in that is awesome. It's just like the humor of that little girl breaking the stick. That's great, too. Mm-hmm. The humor I don't like is when the eyes pop out of the witch's skull.
Yep.
Or like you said, that head spinning around on its neck before it falls off.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
When it takes you out of the moment and goes into unrealism, it doesn't work for me.
And it's a very Beetlejuice thing. It's why I'm not a big fan of Beetlejuice.
True. True that.
Yeah.
I have two other ones. One is that it's not necessarily a key, but it's a bit of trivia, is there is a key to National Velvet in this because... He wanted so much control, he actually wanted to have a mechanical horse for some of the chase sequences. And
yes.
They actually pulled out the one that was used in National Velvet. It was like 50 years old even at the time, and it still worked with a little bit of repair, and they used it as for the horse, mechanical horse.
Yeah, you know, I don't have that in my notes. I need to put that down. I knew it, but I didn't put it down as a key, National Velvet. And I saw them in that documentary. They showed them restoring that device,
yeah,
that Elizabeth Taylor rode. One of the things I was going to mention in trivia that I guess I just didn't put down is the fact that Christopher Walken couldn't ride a horse.
Yes.
And I think he lied. I think he told Burton he could, and then he got cast or something. And he said, oh, by the way, I can't.
And he only had like a week to learn. I think I read that somewhere. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I saw an interview with him. He said, I'm from New York. I've never been near a horse.
I've never been near a horse. Yeah.
Oh, that was too funny.
But the thing that we actors will do to get cast, yes, we will say that.
Right.
You always say yes. Come on.
Well, and I can't imagine that he was that hard up for work. He was pretty well established by then. Another thing Tim Burton said, going back to these old horror movies again, another thing he envisioned of Johnny Depp's Ichabod Crane is the characters played by Peter Cushing and Vincent Price in either Hammer movies or the Roger Corman Poe movies.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes perfect sense because Poe... Well, Price sometimes played villains, but Cushing rarely did. Cushing was usually the good guy.
Yeah, he's usually Van Helsing,
which,
you know, or the good guy, yeah. But I could see Cushing easily playing Ichabod Crane.
Yes, in a heartbeat, especially in this type of role where he's like an investigator with science.
Yes, he would be perfect for this, yes.
What else? The flashback scene in the torture chamber is inspired by The Pit and the Pendulum.
Yep.
Which also stars Vincent Price.
That got me, yes.
And Black Sunday, which is the Iron Maiden.
The Iron Maiden.
Because Barbara Steele is scarred from an Iron Maiden in Black Sunday, which is Mario Bava. Again, homage, homage, homage. Oh, you mentioned that Depp based his character on Roddy McDowall and Basil Rathbone.
Yeah.
But he said that he also based it on Angela Lansbury.
Yeah, the investigator part.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Did you say that? I didn't hear you say that.
No, I didn't. But that makes sense. I didn't read that in any of my research of Angela Lansbury. But it makes sense because she was Murder, She Wrote at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, did you base it on Sherlock Holmes? Well, he's a detective, so yes, sort of, yeah. My Only Last Key is kind of a weird stretch, but it happened when I was watching it. And the whole... concept of a prank going wrong kind of thing, of somebody bothering somebody, and I'm not sure of where the key is or where the stretch is, but it's almost like that Ode to Billy Joe mythos thing where you prank somebody so bad that they either kill themselves, disappear, run away, get out of town. You know, that became a big motif in the 80s, 90s kind of thing. Of those movies
punked?
Where the bullies punk you so bad that you know kill yourself or leave or disappear.
Carrie?
Huh?
Carrie?
Yeah. No, that's the flip side of it. That's they bull me so much, I'm going to take revenge on the whole town.
Right.
You know?
The only other one that I have, and this may not be good, but... it says Sleepy Hollow and a movie called Carry On Screaming from 1966.
I've never heard of that. Never have.
Are pastiches of Hammer horror where an inept detective as the protagonist. They also share a scene where the detective attempts to find a pattern in his clues by writing them down in a random order, producing an answer that is absurdly off mark.
Wow. Okay.
Which happens in this movie, and I guess happened in Carry On Screaming, which I have never seen.
Yeah.
So that was the last one I had.
Well, that is awesome. Tim, this was a good one. I'm glad you picked this one, especially since tomorrow's Halloween. So that's a cool thing.
I agree.
We want to thank you guys for listening to us. That's what we think about it. What do you guys think? Did you like Johnny Depp's interpretation? Did you like the Hammer influences and references? Is this a good horror movie? Would this work, you know, when you throw it up against all the modern audiences who want to watch, you know, Insidious 9 or whatever? Would it scare them at that time? And we'd love to know what
and
you
how
think.
How about that tree, by the way?
Scary tree.
Before you keep... I mean, I'm sure there's a key out there to twisted, gnarly trees like that as well.
Well, what's interesting is look beside me. That's a similar tree to that tree sort of thing. That whole twisty, curvy tree. But we want to know what you guys think. Please leave us a review down below. Leave us your comments. Subscribe, like, do all those kind of things. We would love for you to jump over to the website and glance at older episodes and maybe listen or watch some of the older ones we have. We also have the YouTube channel, of course. And if you're interested in maybe supporting the show, Tim and I would love having your support by subscribing and becoming a Patreon. On our Patreon channel, we have special content that's just for some of the other tiers of Patreon. Two of those are the Dilithium Chamber, which is classic Star Trek, and X-Files Declassified, which is our examination episode by episode of the X-Files. And we've got some other stuff on there, too, from theater to past associations and some other specials that we do just for you guys. Love to hear from you.
Yeah, some bonus, some subscription.
Yeah. So we'd love to have you guys a part of that. And until next week, Tim, when hopefully we'll be going more sci-fi than this scary stuff and cutting people's heads off. But I think...
Well, it will be our last episode before we take a little break for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. It is science fiction. Yeah. And it might even have a tie to this movie.
Ooh, I have to see. See you guys next week.
Yeah. All right.
Bye, Tim. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Johnny Has the Keys. You can learn more about us at our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com, and our Facebook page. Avoid missing shows by subscribing on iTunes and Google Play, and please like, rate, and review us. We're doing this for genre geeks like ourselves, and we can't continue without your support. See you next show, and don't lose your keys.